shaking Vetcher as if he were trapped inside a ringing church bell. But the landing, in which the vehicle expended its last reaction mass to come to a cratering halt outside the chamber, seemed almost soft. There was a final bump, and then Dr. Vetcher spilled from the vehicle, the gel that carried him out, hissing as it hit the superheated stone floor of the palace. Admiral. For the hostages, the transition from anxious fatigue and boredom to chaos was instantaneous. The smart alloy slugs reached their targets well before any sound or shockwave struck the council chamber. The roaring whirlwind seemed to come from nowhere. Blood and liquefied gristle exploded from the four captors. The hostages found themselves choking on the airborne ichor of the eviscerated ricks, mouths and eyes filled with the sudden spray. Moments later, the booms of the palaces shattered and collapsing outer walls came thundering in at the tardy speed of sound, overwhelming the vain shriek of the transponder on the table. Admiral Fenton Pry, however, had been expecting something like this. He had written his War College graduate thesis on hostage rescue, and for the last 4 hours had been quietly stewing over the irony. After a 70-subjective-year career, here he finally was in a hostage situation, but on the wrong end. The latest articles in the infrequent professional literature of hostage rescue even lay on his bedside, printed and handsomely bound by his adjutant, but unread. He hadn't been keeping up lately, but he knew roughly how the attack would unfold and had palmed a silk handkerchief some hours ago. He placed it over his mouth and rose. A horrifying cramp shot through one leg. The Admiral had tried dutifully to perform escape pod stretches, but he'd been in the chair for 4 hours. He limped toward where the Child Empress must be, blinking away blood from his eyes and breathing shallowly. The floor rolled as a heavy portion of the palace's ancient masonry collapsed nearby. Marines coming in? They're too close, the Admiral thought. This was a natural stone building for His Majesty's sake. Admiral Pry could have taught whoever was in charge up there a few things about insertions into pre-ferroplastic structures. Vision cleared as the ichor began to settle in an even patina on the exposed surfaces of the room. The Empress was still seated. Admiral Pry spotted a Rick's commando on the floor. She had landed on her side, doubled up as if put down by a punch to the stomach. The entry wound was invisible, but two pieces of the commando's spine thrust from the gaping exit wound at 45-degree angles. Pry noted with professional pleasure that the slug had struck the commando's chest dead center. He nodded his head curtly, the same gesture he used to replace the words "well done" with his staff. Her blaster, extended toward Child Empress, at arm's length, was untouched. The Admiral lifted her hand from it, careful not to let the rigid fingers pull the trigger, and turned to the Empress's still form. "Milady?" he asked. The Empress's face was twisted with pain. She clutched her left shoulder, gasping for air with ragged breaths. Had the reason been hit with a slug? The Empress was, of course, covered with Rick's blood, but under that her robes seemed to be intact. She certainly hadn't been shot by anything as brutal as a blaster or an exsanguination round. Admiral Pry had a few seconds to wonder what was wrong before the heavy ash doors burst open. Corporal. Marine Corporal Mirami Lau was the first out of her dropship. A veteran of 26 combat insertions, she had set her entry vehicle to the highest egress speed, lowest safety rating. At this setting, the dropship vomited open at the moment of impact, spilling Corporal Lau onto the floor in a cascade of suddenly liquidized G-gel, through which she rolled like a parachutist hitting thick mud. She came up standing. The seal that protected her Varigun's barrel from clogging with gel popped out like a champagne cork, and her helmet drained its entry insulation explosively on the floor around her. Inside her visor, blinking red diagnostics added up the price of her fast egress. Her left leg was broken, the shoulder on that side dislocated. Not bad for a spill at highest setting. The leg was already numbing from automatically injected anesthesia. Her battle armor's servomotors took over its motion. Lau realized that the break must be severe. As the leg moved, she could feel that icy sensation of splintered bone tearing into nerve-dead tissue. She gritted her teeth and ignored the feeling. Once during a firefight on Dantu, Lau had functioned for 6 hours with a broken pelvis. This mission, win, lose, or draw, wouldn't last more than 6 minutes. She confirmed a blinking yellow glyph with her eye mouse and braced herself. Her battle armor huffed as it contracted implosively, shoving her dislocated shoulder back into place. Now that hurt. By now, some 14 seconds after impact, the Marine corporal was oriented to the wireframe map in her secondary vision. To her right, the Marine doctor was rising gingerly up from the gel vomited by his own dropship, disoriented but intact. The vehicle that had brought the apparatus initiate down hadn't spilled yet. It looked wrong, as if the door had buckled in transit. Tough luck. Corporal Lau loped toward the heavy doors that separated her from the council chamber, gaining speed even with her lopsided gait. She was right-handed, but she hit the ashwood doors with her already wounded left shoulder. No sense injuring the good arm. Another spike of pain shot through her as the doors burst open. She tumbled into the council chamber with weapon raised, scanning the room for the Rick's commandos. They were easy to find. All four had fallen, and each was the origin of a long ellipse of thick red ejecta sprayed on walls and floor. A lighter, pink shroud of human blood coated everything in the room, from the ornate settings on the table to the stunned or shrieking hostages. These four Ricks were definitely dead. Lau clicked her tongue to transmit a pre-configured signal to the Lynx. Council chamber secured. "Here!" a voice called. The word came from an old man who wore what appeared, beneath its bloody patina, to be an admiral's uniform. He knelt over two figures, one writhing, one still. The child empress and a dead Rix. Marine Corporal Lau ran to the pair, reaching for a large device on her back. This move caused her wounded shoulder to scream with pain, and her vision reddened at the edges. Lau overrode the suit's suggestion of anesthesia. She needed both arms working at top efficiency. There were three surviving Ricks in the building. This might turn into a firefight yet. The diagnostics on the generator blinked green. It had survived the jump in working order. She reached for its controls, but movement behind her, the helmet extended her peripheral vision to 360 degrees, demanded her attention. Lau spun with her weapon raised, shoulder flaring with pain again. It was the Marine doctor. "Come!" she ordered, her helmet uttering one of the pre-programmed words she could access with a tongue click. Her lungs remained full of drop goo, whose pseudo-alveoli continued to pump high-grade oxygen into her system. "Sir," she added. The man stumbled forward, disoriented as a recruit after his first high-acceleration test. The corporal grabbed the doctor's shoulder and pulled him into the generator's radius. There was no time to waste. The comm signals from the rest of the drop were running through her secondary audio, terse battle chatter as her squad mates engaged the remaining Ricks. Corporal Lau activated the machine, and a level one stasis field jumped to life around the five of them. Empress, lifeless Rick's commando, admiral, doctor, and marine corporal. The rest of the council chamber dimmed. From the outside, the field would appear as a smooth and reflective black sphere, invulnerable to simple blaster fire. The hiss of an oxygen recycler came from the machine. The field was airtight as well. "Sir," Lau commanded. "Heal!" The marine doctor looked up at her, an awful expression visible on his face through the thick, transparent ceramic of his helmet visor. He was trying to speak, a terribly, terribly bad idea. Despite the howl of pain in her shoulder, the imminent danger of Rick's attack, and the general need for her attention to be focused in all directions at once, Lau had to close her eyes when the doctor vomited. Two lungfuls of green oxy-compound splattering onto the inside of his faceplate. She reached over to unseal the helmet. The doctor wouldn't drown in the stuff, naturally, but it was much nastier when you inhaled it the second time. "Captain." "Stasis field up in the council chamber, sir," Executive Officer Hobbs said softly. The words snapped through the wash of visual and auditory reports streaming through the Lynx's infrastructure. Captain Lawrence Zai had to replay them in his mind before he would believe. For the first time in 4 hours, he allowed himself to feel a glimmer of hope. Acoustics had finally analyzed the explosive sound in the council chamber, which had turned out not to be a firearm at all. Probably the glass in which the intelligencer had secreted itself had been overturned, and the crash magnified by the small craft's sensitive ears. So Zai had launched the rescue needlessly, but thus far the rescue was working. Such were the fortunes of war. "Rick's number five dead, 4 more Marines lost," another report came. Zai nodded with approval and peered down into the bridge airscreen. His marines were spread across the palace in a nested hexagonal search pattern, its symmetry only slightly distorted by the exigencies of crashing down from space, avoiding booby traps and fighting the remaining two Rick's commandos. His men were doing quite well. Actually, 17 of the 24 marines were women, but Vadens preferred the old terms. If the Child Empress was still alive, as I thought, he might yet survive this nightmare. Then doubts flooded him again. The Empress could have been killed when the Council Chamber had been railgunned, or when the Marines had burst in to take control. The Ricks might have murdered the Empress the moment they took her hostage, insurance against any rescue. And even if she was alive now, two more Ricks commandos remained concealed somewhere in the tangled diagram of the battle. Phase two, Zai ordered. The Lynx shuddered as its conventional landers launched, filled with the rest of the Lynx's marine complement. Soon the Imperial forces would have total superiority. Every minute in which disaster did not befall him took Laurent Zai closer to victory. "Where's that damned Vetcher?" the captain snapped. "He's under the stasis field, sir," Hobbs answered. Zai nodded. The doctor's battle armor couldn't broadcast through the field, but if the Marines had bothered to put the stasis field up, that implied that the Empress was still alive. "Rick's fire!" The synthesized voice of a Marine came from below. They were still breathing oxycompound in case the enemy used gas. The bridge tactical AI triangulated the sound of blaster fire picked up by various Marines' helmets. A cold blue trapezoid appeared on the wireframe, marking the area where the Rick's commando should be. Zai gritted his teeth. In urban cover, Rick's soldiers were like quantum particles, charms or fetches that existed only as probabilities of location and intent, never as certainties, until they were dead. The nearest edge of the marked area was almost 100 meters from the council chamber, close enough to threaten the Empress, but far away enough to... "Hit that area with another round of railgun slugs," Zai ordered. "But sir," second gunner Thompson protested, "the integrity of the palace is already doubtful. It's not hypercarbon. It's stone. Another round..." "I'm counting on a collapse, gunner," Zai said. "Do you think we'll hit that Rick's woman with dumb luck?" "The stasis field is only level one, sir, but it should hold," Hobbs offered quietly. At least his executive officer understood Zai's thinking. Falling stone wouldn't harm anyone inside a stasis field. Everyone else, the other hostages, the Marines, the rest of the palace staff, was expendable. In fact, the Ricks and the Imperials were in battle armor and wouldn't be killed by a mere building falling down around them. They would simply be immobilized. "Firing!" came the first gunner, and straight bolts of green light leapt onto the air screen, lancing the blue trapezoid-like pins through a cushion. The thunk of the shots reached Zai's soles, adding to all the other sensations of movement and acceleration. What a powerful weapon, he thought, to shake a starship with its recoil, though the shell weighed less than a gram. After four shudders had run through the Lynx, the gunner reported, "First round's fired, sir. The palace seems to be holding up." "Then fire again," Zai said. Senator. The other three senators stood a few meters away from the legislation, a bit daunted by its complexity, its intensity. As Nara Oxum took them through it, however, with simple words and a soothingly cobalt-blue air mouse pointing out particulars, they drew gradually nearer. The legislation consumed most of the air screen in the Secularist Party caucus chamber. A galaxy of minor levies formed its center. Nuisance taxes on arms contractors, surtariffs on the shipment of strategic metals, higher senatorial assessment for regions with a large military presence, all measures that would, directly and indirectly, cost the Imperial Navy hard cash. Surrounding this inner core were stalwart pickets of limited debate, which restricted amendments and forestalled filibuster, and loopholes were ringed with glittering ranks of statutory barbed wire. More items in the omnibus floated in a disorganized cloud, cunningly indirect but obvious in their intent to the trained eye. Duties, imposts, levies, tithes, tariffs, cancelled pork, promised spending temporarily withheld, a host of transfers of economic strength firmly away from the Spinwood reaches, all carefully balanced to undo what the Emperor and Loyalists intended. Senator Oxum was proud that her staff had created so complex a measure in less than an hour. The silver proposal cup at the center of the airscreen was barely visible through the dense glittering forest of iconographics. The edicts flowing from the Diamond Palace were a sledgehammer, an unambiguous step toward war. This legislation, however complex, its point clouds or legislative hieroglyphics, was in its own way just as simple. A sledgehammer swung in return, carefully balanced in force and angle, to stop its counterpart dead with a single collision. Some of the other Secularist Party senators looked unhappy, as if imagining themselves caught between the two. "Are we sure that we need to approach this so confrontationally? Asked Senator Pamir Watt. He pointed timidly at the sparkling line that represented a transport impost, as if it were a downed power line he'd discovered on his front stoop, buzzing and deadly with high voltage. Senator Oxum had cut back on her dosage of apathy in the last hour, tuning her sensitivity for this meeting. She felt Watt's nerves filling the room like static electricity, coruscating with every sudden movement or sharp word. Oxum knew this particular species of anxiety well. It was the particular paranoia of professional politicians. The legislation before them was, in fact, intended to induce exactly such an emotion, an anxiety that made politicians fragile, malleable. Perhaps we could express our concerns in a more symbolic way, Senator Verrin suggested. Reveal all that Senator Oxum has so vigilantly uncovered and open the subject to debate. And give the risen father a chance to respond, Senator Watt added. Oxum turned to face Watt, fixing him with the uncanny blue of her vast-holed eyes. The risen father didn't offer us a symbolic gesture, she said. We haven't been informed, consulted, or even forewarned. Our empire has simply been moved toward war, our constituents put in harm's way while his military engages in this adventure. At these last words, she looked at the third parliamentarian in the room, Senator Arne Mayer, whose stridently secularist homeworld lay in the midst of the Spinwood Reaches and at the high watermark of the Ricks incursion, had helped draft the measure. The most lucrative exports of Mayer's world had, of course, been exempted from Oxum's legislation. Yes, the people have been put in harm's way, Senator Mayer said, in her eyes the distant look of someone listening to secondary audio, and in a fashion that seems deliberately clandestine on the Emperor's part. Mayer cocked her head, and her eyes grew sharp. So I must disagree with the Honourable Verrin when he proposes a symbolic gesture, a mere statement of intent, an unnecessary step, I think. All legislation is symbolic, rhetoric and signifiers, subjunction and intention, until voted upon, at least. Oxum felt the tension go out of the room. This legislation can't really succeed, Watt and Verrin were thinking with relief. It was a gauntlet thrown, a bluff, a signal flare for the rest of the Senate. The measure was sculpted precisely to mirror the Emperor's will, to reveal it in reverse, like a plaster cast. Oxum could have given a long speech listing the details that Niles had found, evidence of imperial intentions, but it would have gone unheard and unnoticed. Pending legislation with major party backing, however, was always carefully scrutinized. Oxum had long ago discovered that a truth cleverly hidden was quicker believed than one simply read into the record. True, said Watt. This bill will send a signal. Verrin nodded his head. A clarion call. Although she and Senator Mayer had planned their exchange for exactly this effect, Oxum found herself a little annoyed at the other senator's quick surrender. With a few modifications, she thought the bill might pass. But Oxum was one of the youngest members of the Senate, and, of course, she was the mad senator. Her party's leaders sometimes underestimated her. So I have your backing? She asked. The three old Solons glanced among themselves, possibly conversing on some private channel, or perhaps they merely knew each other very well. In any case, Oxum's heightened empathy registered the exact moment when agreement came, settling around her mind like a cool layer of mist onto the skin. It was Senator Mayer who nodded, reaching for the silver proposal cup and putting it to her lips. She passed it to Watt, her upper lip stained red by the nanos now greedily sequencing her DNA, mapping the shape of her teeth, listening to her voice before sending a verification code to the Senate's sergeant-at-arms AI. The machine was exquisitely paranoid. It was fast, though. Seconds after Verrin had finished off the liquid in the cup, Oxum's legislation flickered for a moment and reformed in the secularist caucus airscreen. Now the measure was rendered in the cooler, more dignified colors of pending law. It was a beautiful thing to behold. 5 minutes later, as Nara Oxum walked down one of the wide senator's-only corridors of the secularist wing, enjoying the wash of politics and power in her ears and the chemicals of victory in her bloodstream, the summons came. The risen emperor, ruler of the 80 worlds, requested the presence of Senator Nara Oxum. With due respect, but without delay. End of side 2. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over. Side 3, The Risen Empire, by Scott Westerfeld, continuing on page 93. Compound Mind. Alexander did what it could to forestall the invaders. Legis 15's arsenal had been locked out from the compound mine, of course. No Imperial installation this close to the Rix would rely on the planetary infrastructure to control its weaponry. Physical keys and panic shunts were in place to keep Alexander from using the capital's ground-to-space weapons against the Lynx or its landing craft. But Alexander could still play a role in the battle. It moved through the palace, seeing through the eyes of security cameras, listening through the motion detection system, following the progress of the Imperial troops as they stormed the council chamber. Alexander spoke through intercoms to the two Rix commandos left alive after the initial assault, sharing its intelligence, guiding them to harry the rescue effort. But by now, this last stand was merely a game. The lives of the hostages were no longer important to Alexander. The rescue had come too late. It would be impossible for the Imperials to dislodge the compound mine from Legis 15 without destroying the planet's infrastructure. The Rix had won. Alexander noted the local militia flooding into the palace to reinforce the Imperials. The surviving commandos would soon be outnumbered hundreds to one. But the compound mine saw a narrow escape route. It sent its orders, using one of the commandos in a diversion and carefully moving to disengage the other. Alexander was secure, could no more be removed from Legis's infrastructure than the oxygen from its biosphere, but the Imperials would not give up easily. Perhaps a lone soldier under its direct command would prove a useful asset later in this contest. Doctor. Dr. Vetcher felt hands clearing the goo from his eyes. He coughed again, another oyster-sized, salty remnant of the stuff sputtering into his mouth. He spat it out, ran his tongue across his teeth. Foul slivers squirmed in the mass of green covering the floor below him. He looked up, gasping at whoever held his head. A marine looked down at him through an open visor. Her aquiline face looked old for a jumper, composed and beautiful in the semi-darkness. They were inside the hemisphere of a small stasis field. The marine, a corporal, Vetcher saw, clicked her tongue, and a synthesized voice said, "Sir, heal." She pointed at a form lying on the ground. "Oh," Vetcher said, his mind again grasping the dimensions of the situation, now that the imperative of emptying his lungs had been accomplished. Before him, in the arms of a blood-soaked Imperial officer, was the child Empress. She was racked by some sort of seizure. Saliva flecked the Empress's chin, and her eyes were wide and glassy. Her skin looked pale, even for a risen. The way the Empress's right arm grasped her ribcage made Vetcher think. Heart attack. That didn't make sense. The symbiont wouldn't allow anything as dangerous as a cardiac event. Vetcher reached into his pack and pulled out his medical dropcase. He twisted a polygraph around the Empress's wrist and flipped it on, preparing a derm of adrenalog while the little device booted. After a moment, the polygraph tightened, coiling like a tiny metal cobra, and two quick needles popped into the Empress's veins. Synesthesia glyphs gave blood pressure and heart rate, and the polygraph ticked through a series of blood tests for poisons, nanochecks, and antibody assays. The heart rate was bizarrely high. It wasn't an arrest. The blood work rolled past, all negative. Vetcher paused with his hypo in hand, unsure what to do. What was causing this? With one thumb, he pulled open the Empress's eyes. A blood vessel had burst in one, spreading a red stain. The child Empress gurgled, bubbles rising from her lips. "When in doubt, treat for shock," Vetcher decided. He pulled a shock cocktail from his dropcase, pressing it to his patient's arm. The derm hissed, and the tension in the Empress's muscles seemed to slacken. "It's working," the Imperial officer said hopefully. The man was an admiral, Vetcher realized. An admiral, but just a bystander in this awful situation. "That was only a generalized stabilizer," Vetcher answered. "I have no idea what's happening here." The doctor pulled an ultrasound wrap from the dropcase. The admiral helped him wind the thin metallic blanket around the Empress. The wrap hummed to life, and an image began to form on its surface. Vague shapes, the Empress's organs, came into focus. Vetcher saw the pounding heart, the segments of the symbiont along the spine, the shimmer of the nervous system, and something else, just below the heart, something out of place. He activated the link to the medical AI aboard the Lynx, but after a few seconds of humming, it reported connection failure. Of course, the stasis field blocked transmission. "I need help from diagnostics upstairs," he explained to the Marine Corporal. "Lower the field." She looked at the Admiral, chain of command reasserting itself. The old man nodded. The corporal shouldered her weapon and scanned the council chamber, then extended one arm toward the field generator's controls. Before her fingers could reach them, a loud boom shook the room. The corporal dropped to one knee, searching for a target through the sudden rain of dust. Another explosion sounded, this time closer. The floor leapt beneath the doctor's feet, throwing him to the ground. Vetcher's head struck the edge of the stasis field, and looking down, he saw that the marble floor had cracked along the circumference of the field. Of course, Dr. Vetcher realized. The field was a sphere which passed through the floor in a circle around them. The last shockwave had been strong enough to rupture the marble when it was split by the field. Another pair of blasts rocked the palace. Vetcher hoped the floor was supported by something more elastic than stone. Otherwise, their neat little circle of marble floor was likely to fall through to the next level, however far down that was. Screams from the hostages came dimly through the stasis field. A few decorative elements from the ornate ceiling had fallen among them. A chunk of rock bounced off the black hemisphere above Vetcher's head. "Those idiots!" cried the Admiral. "Why are they still bombarding us?" The Marine Corporal remained unflappable. Nudging one booted toe against the cracked marble at the edge of the field, she looked up at the ceiling. She pulled off her helmet and vomited professionally, as neatly as the most practiced alcoholic, the green goo in her lungs spilling onto the floor. "Sorry, Doctor," she said. "I can't lower the field. The ceiling could go any second. You'll have to do without any help for now." Vetcher rose shakily, nodding. Metallic taste had replaced the salty strawberry of the oxy compound. He spat into his hand and saw blood. He'd bitten his tongue. "Perfect," he muttered and turned toward his patient. The ultrasound wrap was slowly getting the measure of the child Empress's organs, shifting like a live thing, tightening around her. The shape below the Empress's heart was clearer now. Vetcher stared in horror at it. "Damn!" he swore. "It's..." "What?" the Admiral asked. The Marine took her eyes from the open council chamber's doors for a moment to look over his shoulder. "Part of the symbiont, I think." The palace shook again. Four tightly grouped blasts rained dust and stone fragments onto the field over their heads. Vetcher simply stared. "But it shouldn't be there," he said. Private Basiritz, who came from a grey village where a single name sufficed, found himself regarding minute cracks in the stone floor of the palace of Child Empress Anastasia Vista Carmen. A moment before, a hail of seeking bullets had rounded the corner before him, a flock of flaming birds that filled the hallway with light and high-pitched screams, driving him to the ground. Fortunately, Basiritz's reflexes were rated in the top thousandth of the highest percentile of Imperial-ruled humanity. In that realm of professional athletes, stock market makers, and cobra handlers. This singular characteristic had given him passage through the classes in academy, where he often struggled, not so much unintelligent as undersocialized. Raised in a provincial sector of a gray planet where technology was treated with due respect, but the underlying science ridiculed for its strange words and suppositions. The academy teachers taught him what they could and quietly promoted him, knowing he would be an asset in any sudden explosive combat situation, such as the one in which he now found himself. He was a very fast young man. None of the small, whining Rick's projectiles had hit Basiritz, nor had they, by the Celeritas standards of the event, even come close. His eyesight was awfully good, too. Throw a coin 10 meters and Basiritz could run and catch it, the cold side facing up in his small yellow palm. The rest of humanity drifted through Basiritz's reality with the tardy grace of glaciers. Vast, dignified creatures who evidently knew a lot of things, but whose movements and reactions seemed deliberately, infuriatingly slow. They seemed dazzled by the simplest situations. A glass fell from a table, a ground car suddenly hurtled toward them, the news sheet was pulled from their hand by a gust of wind, and they flailed like retarded children. Why not just react? But this Rick's woman, now she was fast. Basiritz had almost killed her a few moments ago. With the servos in his armor set to stealth and his varigun pre-charged to keep it quiet, he'd crawled into a cunning position behind the Rick's woman, separated from her only by the translucent bricks that formed the sun wall in this part of the garden. The enemy commando was pinned by supporting fire from squadmates Astra and Saman, who were smart enough to let Basiritz do the killing. Their variguns pummeled the area with fragmentation projectiles, kicking up a maelstrom of flying glass and micro-barbed shrapnel and keeping the Rick's woman down, down, down. She knelt and crawled, and her shadow was warped and twisted by the crude hand-blown shapes of the brickwork, but from this angle Basiritz could see to shoot her. He set his varigun, a difficult weapon that forced Basiritz to choose how to kill someone, to its most accurate and penetrating ammo type, a single ball shot of magnetically assisted ferrocarbon, and fired. That setting was a mistake, however. Just as Basiritz never understood the relativistic equations that made his parents and sisters grow old so quickly, fading visibly with every visit home, and that had stolen his